This episode is brought to you by The Manor, a premier addiction treatment facility in the hills of Wisconsin's Kettle Moraine Forest. Their program offers a tailored approach to those struggling with addiction in a secluded setting with no more than 11 men and women. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love are struggling with addiction, call The Manor at 414-930-1930. That's 414-930-1930. You can learn more about The Manor by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting discoverthemanor.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
Falling squares on TV screens.
I'm Dr. Chantel Thomas, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. My name's Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. And here we go with part two of my conversation with Dr. Chantel Thomas. Hope you enjoyed the first part. We pick up right where we left off for part two. So here you go. Enjoy, Dr. Chantel Thomas.
Just the product of some bad seeds. Just some guys that grew into weeds.
This piece that you're speaking to, which is, you know, their inner wisdom, their most, their highest self, their most authentic self, which is, again, I'll credit internal family systems from the way that they've used it, is that we all have this capital S big self, right, which is about, you know, when you're in your highest self or when you're in your most evolved self, you know, you're calm, you're non-reactive, you're compassionate, curious, connected, like all these things. And that is a vital part of what guides you in decision making. But if you tell someone that everything, every instinct that comes from you is part of an addictive and diseased process, you know, where does it leave people?
Yeah. Well, and I don't know, you know, there's these things, and I, you know, the 12 step program saved my life. I mean, there's no two ways about it, but, I learned at some point in recovery, you know, 15 or so years, that those early lessons don't always serve me further down the road. And an example came up yesterday in a group where this guy who's, you know, he's been sober over 20 years, says, you know, I mean, he was really kind of sideways about something, having a lot of feelings and, you know, needed to get out of himself, you know, and I'm like, or you could feel it, you know, or you could feel it because you're not an emotional cripple.
Right.
You've been sober for over 20 years. Like you're going to be okay. If you have feelings, you don't have to avoid them anymore. It made sense in early recovery, maybe to avoid the really distressing feelings because that's when you tended to drink.
Yes.
But, you know, we're a ways past that now. It's okay to believe in yourself. Like,
That's super interesting how you, you know, pair that concept, because it, I do think a lot of the strategies are like, don't go too deep inside yourself. I always say like the program, the 12-step program is like really perfectly fitted for for a certain level of narcissism. Like, it's built for like narcissistic men. I don't believe that across the board, but in some ways, you know, a lot of the solutions are to stop focusing on you. Like, don't make it about you. Be of service to other people. Don't use your own, you know, barometer to make choices. You know, it's really about examining what ego is, ego inflation in the face of a, you know, addictive disorder. And so it's very interesting what you're saying in terms of, how does that kind of just avoidance of the inner experience to some extent? And believe me, when it's executed in its full entirety, like, I have tremendous admiration and respect for how the program works. And the idea, you know, its answer to shame and the fourth step and potentially how it can be executed can be extraordinarily powerful and beautifully accountable, but it gets, it's implemented by humans and they have their own interpretation of what that means and how, you know, some of the principles get weaponized against people. And, you know, the big debate about whether or not therapy is useful, you know, if you can just work the 12-step program, is that enough? And it's super interesting because we are definitely an emotion-focused treatment model here, because I believe that your access to your inner wisdom, and this isn't invented by me, this is, you know, borrowed from a lot of people who've been talking about this for years in the field and studying this, both inside and outside of addiction, that your way through to access your own, you know, your own inner healing and wisdom comes through your ability to feel your feelings.
Right. They're informative.
They actually tell you what is needed, right? And it's just, there's so much conditioning and programming that I feel like we try to undo, particularly, I mean, for both our male and female clients, but I'll tell you, men, there's a number that gets done on them in its own right around permission to feel, support to feel, like I know that you have spoken about this really beautifully. The way in which there's just no access to even words to describe what's happening internally and what a heartbreaking sadness that is, that people, either one, were not gifted the opportunity to have a reflective experience. It just wasn't gifted to them and cultivated in them. And there's no language to talk about the parts of them that feel terrified and scared and vulnerable and weak without feeling inadequate and masculine or unworthy. So much of it is just very basic. Well, what do you give yourself permission to feel? That's going to be part of the path.
Yeah. For and you know, this thing though, I mean, especially with men is, you know, it's beyond like sad.
Yeah.
It's dangerous. No, it's dangerous.
It is 100% dangerous.
Because,
yes.
I mean, not to get overly political here, but you think about who we have in the White House.
Yeah.
He is not emotionally balanced. Whether you say he's a good president, it's kind of hard to deny that he's not emotionally literate. And he's, you know, if you know anything about this stuff, you can see it on live TV. He's coming from a place of fear all the time. Well, think of the implications. This is the leader of the free world.
It's super
who's
fascinating.
Building a wall to keep people out. I mean, come on. Like, so, but
I also think he's such a trope of a version of masculinity that feels really familiar and reassuring to a lot of people, which I find, I mean, to me, it feels a little heartbreaking because of the implications for other people who are kind of at the hand of that. But that bravado is something that's been really built into our culture around what it means to be manly.
And it's really, it's a substitute for masculinity is what it is.
Correct.
But, you know, I think that a lot of what this is about. I mean, when you come from an unhealthy family, that's what feels familiar. And that's what it's easy for you to love, right? So if you have a bunch of kids who are traumatized, like when I say kids, I mean baby boomers who voted for him.
Yeah.
Like he's their dad, you know,
it's an archetype.
Yeah.
It's an archetype for sure. For certain, there's an archetype there. And quite frankly, the way that things are spoken about are in very simple terms.
Mm-hmm.
It's very reductionistic, right?
Yeah.
And so it doesn't require you to hold the gray.
Right, right.
Right? I mean, it's like, this is pretty simple. You're either good or you're bad. You're winning or you're not winning, right? Like, so
which is a symptom of codependency, by the way.
So are you saying Trump's codependent?
I'm saying as a culture, we're pretty codependent. I mean, when that's what people gravitate towards, you know, extreme thinking, black or white,
yes,
in or out. I mean, that's the gray area is where the good stuff is.
But it's also where the conflict is, right? And the ambivalence and the holding of the uncertainty. And if I can't, you know, in our culture, we're conditioned to want to put things in boxes and mm-hmm. labels and containers. I mean, look at our entire mental health industry. I mean, I understand, you know, the power of the diagnosis. I mean, there's some programs that are built around the concept that, like, oh, we will find the diagnosis. And it's like,
we will tell you what's wrong with you.
But even that, it's like, okay, so now you have it, which, by the way, not to, disparage the tremendous brains that went into formulating the DSM, but, you know, people arrive at a diagnosis and they feel like it's the conclusion of what's needed. And I always say, I don't really care about your diagnosis. I want to understand, you know, especially when it comes to complex personality issues. Oh, well, they have a personality disorder. And I go, that doesn't mean anything to me. What does that mean in terms of how you're going to engage with them?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, circling back to this concept of, like, do people have the capacity for healing within their own persona? You know, addict becomes another, you know, stigmatized label, just like a personality disorder does, where, oh, this person isn't really helpable because they're too manipulative. They don't have enough insight. They're too deceptive. What do you tell yourself about that label that allows you to stop being vulnerable in your treatment relationship, that allows you to stop trying, that allows you to stop looking at yourself as part of the outcome of the treatment equation? That you are not removed from it. What comes out of the treatment, if you believe in a relational model, which I absolutely do, you are co-creating the experience of healing for someone through your relationship.
Mm.
And it never comes from just one side. It's a relationship.
Right.
Which is why the rigor behind self-evaluation becomes so critical when you're treating relational trauma. And if you're not committed to doing that, you know, rigorous self-reflection, I'm not sure you should be doing that work.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you know, one thing I just want to go back to the 12 step stuff that I thought about, you know, the whole thing of, you know, people taking themselves too seriously. I mean, Bill Wilson called AA spiritual kindergarten. So it's not the end all be all. It's the beginning of a process. And, and you know, I think deep down I've always had a conviction about that and a recognition that, you know, this is only part of it, and I don't want to get too attached to this and too invested. And I hope that doesn't sound terrible, but it's not all that I am.
Mm-hmm.
I never wanted to be reduced to that, you know, because I feel like we're all human beings with lives and family. You know, it's not just as simple as, oh, he's a drunk or he's an addict or he has a personality disorder, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Trauma survivor. You know, we're people. We're people first.
Yeah, and I think there's a small subset. Well, I don't know if it's small. I think there's a subset of people where naming it as such gave them relief, right?
Right.
Where it, that provided relief. But most of the people that I treat, that's not the case.
Right.
Like, resting on the label of drunk does not provide relief. It provides tremendous shame.
Right.
And I also work from a place, like in my own personal therapeutic work, at times the terror of being in relationship, whether it be in intimate relationships or even a therapeutic relationship, is, will you ever really see me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, will you really see me? And not the story you've told yourself about me, or the label that I live under, or right. the thing that I'm really good at putting forward first.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I have a personal responsibility to reveal those other parts of myself. But there's, and I think it's very similar for a lot of our clients in reverse. There's a deep desire to be seen and not categorized prematurely. And yet at the same time, there's a deep fear of being really seen. And it's yeah. that dichotomy of wanting that intimacy and being terrified of it that is the nexus where I believe really powerful relational healing happens.
Mm. Wow. This is good stuff, right? I mean, yeah, we could go on and cool. on like this, yeah. right?
Totally.
So,
yeah.
Now, did you know at a young age that you wanted to help people, or how did this happen?
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think I came by my caretaking pretty genuinely. I think it caused me a lot of angst pretty early on as a, you know, 10-year-old, 9-year-old. There was definitely a desire to create peace and harmony around me.
Mm.
And when that didn't happen, it created a lot of worry for me, a lot of probably anxiety. And I figured out pretty early on that in most circles that was not viewed as a strength, that was like a some form of a weakness. Because interestingly, circling back to the whole codependency movement, it was kind of hitting its speed when I was a kid, because my dad was a physician, but he was a pretty curious guy, and he was very interested in, you know, quote unquote, self-help books and mm-hmm. figuring people out, you know. The Healing the Inner Child was on our bookshelf. I remember seeing it as a really little kid,
mm-hmm.
On our bookshelf, and, some of Bradshaw's books. And so I think the language of codependency got thrown around pretty early. And so I think I was in a little bit of conflict about maybe the pathologizing of that desire to be in really close connection with mm-hmm. people. So it took me a while to sort through it, and I always knew that I loved being with people and being around them and being connected to them. But, I think it just took some time for me to understand how to quiet some of the need for approval, letting go of not being liked by everyone.
Mm.
I mean, that's still in me for sure, but I've fortunately shortened the list quite a bit. it's a much shorter list.
Yeah, me too.
But it's, you know, I mean, I think it's this belief, you know, not wanting to pathologize everything, right? There's the, you can use it for good and you can use it to torture yourself. And how do you build on the inherent instincts of what it means to be in relationship and understand them and have compassion for it, as opposed to, you know, kind of sit in critical evaluation of it. So I think, at one point I thought about becoming a physician because my father was a physician. Both my brother and sister became doctors as well. And then I think I was able to sort through after being pre-med for a little bit. I was willing to ask the question, like, okay, what is this really about for you? What's really driving this? And I don't think I had a super positive concept of a psychologist or of a therapist very early on, because I think, in my dad's hierarchical world, that was like kind of a sub category,
like kind of half a doctor.
It's like,
like in the same category as chiropractors.
Oh my Lord. Yes. Oh, you've been around physicians, so you must get it. So, so, you know, I think I kind of put that off to the side and thought, well, that's, you know, it's like, if you're going to do it, you know, my dad would have probably said at the time, become a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
So it kind of went a bit of a different direction, and I was really drawn to literature, reading books and poetry. I mean, I think you and I were talking about the other day, I was really into Frost and writing my own poems when I was younger. And what I appreciated, and I wouldn't do it differently, is that I liked history, I liked philosophy, and I liked understanding kind of the inner experience of humans, and literature is kind of that place, right?
Yeah.
Where it all comes together. And what I loved about, like, the more advanced study of literature was the idea of the manifest content and the latent content. Mm-hmm. So what is the story that you read? And then what does this represent? What's the metaphor? I think it's amazing training to be a clinician, to have that experience of what does it mean to always be looking deeper than the surface content. And of course, knowing that all of our best poets and authors and writers are often pretty tortured souls. And so there was a lot of solace in that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember reading I was a pretty melancholy kid, and I remember reading Letters to a Young Poet in college. Oh my gosh, it was like, it provided me such relief. Like, oh, I can take this pain, these feelings that I don't know what to do with, and I can turn them into creation. Like, I can use this as fuel to create something. Because I grew up in an environment where my emotionality, my quote unquote sensitivity, wasn't really, seen as an asset.
Well, we pathologize that as a culture.
Oh, totally.
You know? I mean, I had that sensitive label from certain so parts of my, which is just, you know, ridiculous.
Oh, it's so sad. And I think about all these sensitive little creatures, right?
But here's what's interesting about what you were just saying. I think that one of the missing pieces, especially with men and emotions, because emotions bring vitality to our life experience. Yes. And what you were saying about creating something from your emotions,
yes,
something literary, I mean, that's just one way.
Totally.
And, you know, like, anger's there to motivate us. Other emotions are there. Like, fear has its purpose. They're all informative in different ways. And one of the expressions that I like to use is when you're like activated or triggered or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's an opportunity to heal.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is. And if you recognize it as that and you're not afraid of it, then maybe you write a poem.
Right.
Or you do something with it, but you don't avoid it anymore.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, this is, I feel like that's part of what I'm supposed to be doing is kind of finding a way to go with this stuff that isn't really being talked about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, just the idea that we should limit our emotional experience is just ludicrous. If you really think about it, I mean, like it, feeling is a bodily function, right? I mean, would we try to limit any of our other bodily functions? I mean, maybe if there was something wrong with us, you know, but it's the same kind of thing because we carry it in our bodies and it stays until we experience it.
I was listening to a podcast actually that a colleague of mine out of Boulder was named Craig Salerno was talking about, he was able to articulate something that I have known to be that I've known to be true, but I don't know if I quite would put it into words in the same way. But he basically was saying how the most sensitive creatures in our society often end up becoming individuals who struggle with substance use disorders, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's that beautiful sensitivity that just when not supported, not nurtured and depathologized. And when you're told it's too much, you're too much for the world or for me to tolerate, you have to find other ways to tighten the valve or numb it out because it's just too much. And the resourcefulness in trying to figure that out. And then the absolute sadness in the fact that it works for a long period of time. Yeah. And a lot of folks, when they first get sober, can't feel anything at all for a good period of time.
Yeah.
They just don't even know what is happening internally. And there's so much fear associated with their interior and who they really are. And the messages they've been given about you are too much or you're, there's something wrong with you, right? That process of being given permission to feel and not only being given permission, but celebrating your emotional world is this amazing, to your point, like this is where the color comes. This is where the vitality comes. I say this in group all the time, like all the people you want to listen to, whether it be musicians, artists, theater, movie, cinema, the works that move people are almost always created with people who are feeling.
Right.
Like they're feeling.
And they create a feeling.
And they create a feeling in you. And that's not weak. That's badass.
Yeah.
I mean, that is like cool and powerful and transformational.
Yeah. Whew. So, okay. This has been great.
It's been so fun.
Yeah. So, anything big on the horizon for you?
Yeah, there's some new things percolating. One of which is, you know, inspired by you, my friend, starting to do our own little podcast.
Well, if that's true, then I, you know,
it's true. Of course, it's true. You're definitely part of the experience. Well,
yeah, but that makes me feel good to know that I inspired that at least partially.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, it's fun. I mean, I think you're experiencing that right now. I mean, totally. I have really enjoyed this and, you know, is there anything about you that, cause part of this, I wanted to get to know you too. I mean, it's so easy for us to talk about work, but, Is there any part of you that you wish more people knew about you? Anything about you that you wish more people knew?
Great question.
Thank you.
I think it's more about what I've given myself permission to really own.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that I must not be very good at leading with it in most circles, but I think I've discovered, like, over time, like, I think I do have a really big heart.
Mm.
And there have been moments in my life, because I think I had to work really hard early on to be seen and to meet some of my needs. I became really afraid of my ability to navigate people. Mm-hmm. And I saw it as something that I should be almost afraid of inside myself. And I think what that did was obscure my ability to really understand what my heart is. And I think in working with clients, and in particularly in working with them in a really deep way, it has reaffirmed for me how much of my heart is involved in the work that I do, but also what it means to be in connection with other people, and feeling really proud of the fact that I'm very easily moved.
Mm. Yeah, I am too. Wow. What a great answer.
Thank you. Thanks for asking.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I'm sure I would be surprised if this isn't where you come from, because it is me, that, you know, these tools that we learn to use in the work that we do, that's what they are. I mean, they're tools to use for how to love people.
Totally.
That's really what this is. That's the answer.
I couldn't agree more. I was really afraid to say that I loved my clients when I was working with them early on. But their part of it is definitely about love.
Yeah.
No question.
And I remember right into treatment, like very early on, and I'm still the person who was my therapist. We still talk, and I actually worked for her at one point, and you know, we still talk, and I trust her. And but I remember her saying to me in a session, and I, you know, I was crying about something. I mean, it was a week into treatment, not even, and you know, not a great time. Tom wasn't on a winning streak back then, but I remember her just saying to me, you know, I love you, and I know that you don't understand how that could possibly be true, but it is. And that was just such a powerful moment for me. And she was exactly right. I believed her, but I didn't understand it. Now I understand it, because, you know, it's an energy that we convey, you know, it's a spirit in us that we share with other people, you know, whether it's just being kind or positive or, you know, but for me, it's acknowledging that it's there in the moment, you know, and speaking from that place. And a lot of times it's, you know, I'm really sorry you're going through this right now. You know, I wish, you know, I understand some of it, but I haven't experienced it, and I don't know what it's like to feel the way that you do, but I see your suffering, and I'm sorry. And that just, mm-hmm. it, people, you get somewhere with that, you know?
Absolutely.
It's a lot different than wagging your finger at somebody, you know? Just works a lot better. But, you know, you have to be in touch with that to be able to use it and do it. You can't, well, you can't be hiding. You mentioned hiding. You can't be hiding and you got to show yourself.
Yeah. And part of that showing yourself is being the willingness to be vulnerable. Like the, you know, if you don't feel vulnerable in your therapy, I don't care if you're the client or the therapist, then there's something missing. Mm. I'm not saying the entire time, but I think I've been in the room with people who feel as though they're operating above the person they're helping.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no real vulnerability there, right? And so I really do believe the magic of the interconnection, what you create in the context of that relationship, the healing agent of connection, really only comes when you're both on the same level. Like, and what comes with that is the vulnerability of being able to talk about it. Like, for a therapist to say, I love you, to a client where they've had a deep, meaningful, and long-lasting relationship, that's a that's a demonstration of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And how powerful, right?
Well, you know, and I've been in situations over the years, I mean, I could probably count them on one hand, but, you know, where I just cried.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember one experience with a client where, you know, I was trying to block an AMA, you know, leaving against medical advice. Yes. And it was just this, there was so much. I saw how much danger this kid was in. I cared about him. It, you know, there'd been so much heart that I put into.
Yes.
And it was just like nothing I could say was, and, you know, eventually at some point I thought, you know, I'm really upset. Maybe what I do is model appropriate behavior for this kid right now. And they came out and I held my head in my hands and I cried, you know?
It's so powerful. And, you know, I chuckled for a second, not because, I mean, there was a moment here in treatment. It was probably, I'd been here for maybe a year. And again, there was a client who I felt like the stakes were really high and I knew we hadn't gotten through and I just couldn't get access at all. So they were leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I was totally helpless in that moment. And I felt a real sense of danger and care for the person. And I worked my hardest, and again, another exercise in humility and what I actually can't control, and et cetera, et cetera. And I came out of that session and I went straight into group to facilitate. And one of our clients looked at me, sat down, and he's a pretty good soul. And he looked at me and he just said, "How are you?" But he meant it. Oh, and I burst into tears, and all the clients in the group just looked at me like, "Oh my God, what's happening to her?"
Yeah.
And I said, "You know what? I just had a really difficult conversation and I'm okay. Like, I don't want to overwhelm you. Like, I still feel like I can be present here. I appreciate you asking." And I just owned it. I said, this work is humbling. And you're just aware of how much you can't do at times when people are really in danger. And it's really moving.
Mm-hmm.
But man, the split second on everyone's face as I just, that was not a like calculated, well, let me model none of that. I just lost.
Well, just. But you know, if they don't know you care, nothing else matters. It just doesn't.
Right. Yeah. I think that's the piece that I think a lot of people don't see about me, because I do, you know, it's a delicate dance in projecting confidence and with this work, like, it's very hard to earn people's trust if you don't really believe in what you're doing. And so I think a lot of people might miss, you know, that sensitivity piece. Like, I really, again, back to kind of my heart. And so I think it's pretty shocking when it happens, though. My staff have all seen me cry multiple times over, but I've never, I wasn't in control of the valve in that moment at all.
Yeah. That is scary.
And I thought, oh my God, what if this doesn't stop? And then I thought, well, I'll just let them know I need a minute. I worked through it and it just kind of passed through me. And
well, so here's something that I've heard therapists say, I believe.
Yeah.
And I'm curious your take on it. Mm-hmm. The tears that you cry alone are of half the value of the tears you cry in someone else's presence. Do you believe that?
Wow. I haven't heard that. I would say that there is great value potentially to both. And if you can convince someone that when they're crying, that they're doing exactly what they need to honor themselves.
Mm-hmm.
My biggest concern when people cry alone is this, what are they telling themselves about what's happening? And mm-hmm. so the benefit of crying in the presence of being held by another person is that you can use that person as a reference point for self-compassion, mm-hmm. for kindness, for safety. And so I think if you can really embed in someone great compassion when they're in their pain, mm-hmm. that it can be incredibly important to give yourself permission to feel, mm-hmm. whether you're with someone or not. It's just so much harder to control the narrative of what's happening when someone drops in, because what I've noticed about most people I work with, as soon as they drop into the crying or the, you know, whatever emotional field they feel themselves being pulled into, there's a resistance against it, mm-hmm. that makes it just a struggle, or they turn in on themselves and start just, they're so brutal to themselves and yeah. so hard on themselves. And so the narrative is like, no one can help me. This is never going to get any better. And also, what is wrong with me that I'm feeling this way, mm-hmm. right? It's all so harsh and judgmental and critical that the opportunity for healing through that feeling just disappears, because right. it gets completely overshadowed by the other narrative, right? And so I don't know if I would reduce it in that way, the phrase that was just said, but I think there's potentially more safety
mm-hmm.
when if the person you happen to be across from is actually safe enough to hold the space for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but you know, just getting comfortable enough to experience your own feelings goes an awful long way. Just giving yeah. yourself permission to do it. And I talk about this a lot with guys. You know, we experience sadness and then we beat ourselves up because we tell ourselves we're not supposed to feel that way. And it's like,
yes.
it makes it 10 times worse. Yes. We're doing that to ourselves, and it's not true. Like, however yeah. you feel is the way you're supposed to feel. I mean, that's, you know, so
yeah.
There's a yeah. quote that I really love by this guy, Sam Keen, who's a philosopher and he's written about men. And it's that we can only choose whether we will feel and not what we will feel. And I think that's true. And I think
100%
when yeah. we numb ourselves, we don't get to choose if we only numb ourselves from the sadness. We also mm-hmm. numb ourselves from the joy.
Yes. That it's like a lot of the work that we hear is like kind of creating a sales pitch for why you would want to feel.
Right.
Like, what's in it for
right.
me?
I know it's scary.
But guess what? There's more.
Yeah.
Here's all the great things that, you know, come from feelings. And it's, you know.
Well, and that's where it can get really overwhelming to think about how hard it is for someone to remain abstinent. Because, to enter abstinence, because there's a lot of work to be done. I mean, you got to be willing to do a lot of work. And I've said over the years, if I knew when I first got sober, if I knew, I might not have. I might not have. I mean, I'd like to think I would have, but man.
Yeah. It's courageous. Oh my gosh. Like the courage that's ultimately required to sustain.
Yeah.
Living without having that escape hatch all the time.
Right.
I mean, that's why I say, like, look, the path that you're on, there is absolutely no part of me that believes that my clients are inferior to people, to normies. Yeah. Like, I just don't believe it on any level. And so, what they're being called to do is live a more evolved existence in sobriety. It's just a reality. Like, not everybody else has to hold themselves accountable and, you know, be in their experience in the same way. And that's not to say that other process things can't come up that take you out of your experience, but it is a calling that requires so much more presence. And I mean, it's inspiring to see people who navigate it. I mean, I have nothing but complete and total admiration for people who are able to sustain it. When someone tells me that they're sober, I mean, I don't know. In my world, like, that is just like, I mean, I just, hats off. Like, I mean, I feel like they deserve a round of applause everywhere they go. Like, it's an extraordinary calling to be in yourself and to not have those easy ways to disappear. It's really incredibly powerful when executed and sustained. I mean, it's incredibly courageous.
Well, and you know, the whole superhero saying, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, one of the things I teach guys is, you know, we have to have a reason to be sober.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you don't have that, it's probably not going to happen. And if you don't have it, you better find it. If this is what you want, you got to figure out what it is that you want. And, you know, for me, it became a sense of purpose, you know, initially like, to change, to be able to help other people. And then as I've gotten older, you know, I've had opportunities to like be the guy in my family who people call when one of them's a mess, you know?
Yeah.
And I've put I got more nephews than some people have family members. And I've put a lot of them in treatment. But you know, I mean, that's a gift, and it is, it's a blessing to be able to do that. I think that what we do is a privilege that we get to be there with people at the most vulnerable place in their lives and to witness the change and help them hopefully usher their way into a different, you know, a fork in the road or whatever, you know, a different way of life. It's powerful. It is. And when it happens, man, it's unbelievable. It's so cool.
It's so true. And it is, like, I couldn't agree more. And I say this to clients, and I know some of them, like, I try not to oversay it, but it is an honor. Like, it really does feel like an honor. That, to that point, like, to be able to, be alongside of someone in places that have never felt safe enough to share or expose to someone. I mean, wow.
Yeah.
Like, what a tremendous gift what an honor, and how, you know, I feel that there's a lot I have to do on my end to demonstrate my worthiness of that kind of trust.
Mm. Wow. That's such a great attitude. I'm glad you're doing this kind of work. It makes me feel good to know that you're doing this and watching over people, you know?
Oh, that's a really nice compliment coming from you.
All right. So if there was some point in your life when you needed to go back and tell your younger self, give her a piece of advice, she was struggling, you know, when would that have been, and what would you say to her?
Probably around 7 or 8. And it would be, I would circle back to the idea that, your sensitivity is not a liability, and that your access to your feelings will ultimately be the thing that helps you reach people.
Wow. That's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been a blast. It's going to be, yeah. I think we might have 2 episodes here, but we'll figure that out.
It was so nice, Tom. Thank you for being, yeah, just thanks for being you. Yeah. It was really special for me too. And it was, you know, it's what I needed on multiple fronts. So thank you. Be well, my friend.
Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If you'd like to learn more about our guest, you can find links in the show notes or visit our website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, if you have a suggestion for a topic, or you know someone who would make a great guest, email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you know someone else who would enjoy the show, or even just a particular episode, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider becoming one wherever it is you choose to listen. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can hear episodes before they're released publicly. You can gain access to supplemental content. There are other benefits in the various tiers. Visit patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Join our Facebook community or follow the show on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. We also have a YouTube channel. You can connect with us on Twitter or Pinterest. To hear the songs from this and every episode, you can find the Path to Authenticity playlist on Spotify. Obviously, there are a lot of ways you could be spending your time, so I appreciate you spending some of it here with me. I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. Be nice. The path to authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit Equivox.com.